evening. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. It's about 6 p.m. and this is In the Motherhood. My name is Robin Fadden, and on today's In the Motherhood, we're going to hear from Montreal-based educator and artist Sarah Mangle. She'll be talking about her child-centered, holistic approach to early childhood education and how she and most other educators have had to make, obviously, major shifts during the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as other voices to broader conversations about social change that are going on, and the role of meaningful childcare and education in our society, especially when we're having these conversations about racism and sexism and showing how they permeate into every aspect of our lives. So it's a very interesting conversation. I'd like to thank journalist and home daycare provider Joanne Penhale for sharing this conversation with In the Motherhood. And I'd like to thank Sarah as well. If you'd like to look at some of Sarah's art, and as well as her daily email art prompts that she's been sending out, you can find her at sarahmangle.ca, sarahmangle.ca, as well as on Facebook, Sarah Mangle, and on Instagram, same handle. I'll get right into that conversation now. Thanks for listening to CKUT.
So we're more than 3 months into living with COVID-19, and I was wondering if you could describe what your job was like before that all hit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, at Over the Rainbow.
Yeah. Okay, so I worked as a kind of a full-time educator, but on a part-time schedule. So I worked 9 to 2, and I have my own group of 8 kids called the Waves, and they were mostly around 3.5. And we had a regular schedule. We spent the morning together in a small group. Over the Rainbow is a center of 30 kids, and there's 5 educators, but 4 groups based on how the timing works. And so we all sort of share a collective space, but within our small sort of units. And we would start by eating snack together, and then doing a little book and discussion time, and then often some outdoor exploration. And then we would do yoga together and have a talking circle and eat lunch.
So was your daily schedule really pretty set, or was there a lot of flexibility depending on how kids were feeling?
So Over the Rainbow is special for many reasons. And one of them is that the director, Wendy Getvay, she really wants the educators to truly bring their unique selves, like to really shine as individuals, as a sort of model to show the kids that they also can shine. And also to allow us to sort of bring our passion to the work and have that be kind of a sustaining energy to keep us going in this work that's like both inspiring but also tiring. So the schedule that I kept was really like of my own creation. And so it was meant to sort of contain, the children so they felt safe to have whatever emotion they had. And I think it did do that. So you can feel grumpy and not like listening to the story, and you can bring your grumpy self to story time kind of thing. And if you're doing yoga, if it's yoga time, but you just want to chill on your blanket, like that's fine. So there's no forced participation of like any kind, but their bodies could expect a certain rhythm to the day.
Okay. And so say that grumpy kid that doesn't want to be part of the story time, what if they just like, they really don't want to be part of the story time and they want to be kind of physically away? Is that okay too?
Well, I would say, because for me, like that age group, like 3.5 to 4, it's a time when there's like some individuation happening, but also a longing to be a part of a group. Right. And sometimes that learning that you're a part of a group is painful for young people. And so if a child is saying, I don't want to, I want to sit over here, what I often saw that too was actually an invitation to express belonging. You know, it's like their young hearts are saying, this is hard, I feel tender, and I I don't feel a part, but I actually need to. So I would say you do need to, you know, you do need to sit with us, even if it feels hard, because even when you're grumpy, you're a part of this group and we love you.
Hmm. And
so does it was that kind of emotional, it was that kind of like emotional holding.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I want to explore this idea of what you said a little bit more about Wendy Getvey having all of the educators that were our teachers at Over the Rainbow shine as their unique selves. How was how was that established?
Like, well, she really gave us the responsibility. Well, we had lots of meetings every Friday, but she, so I've worked at a handful of other centers in Toronto and Guelph and Montreal. And there's often this sort of top-down curriculum that's especially in Ontario, based on the way the ministry has decided to regulate daycares. There's a lot of like, what are you doing for fine motor today? And what, and how can you show it on the wall? And what are you doing for, so the rules in Quebec are a little bit less like in the minute details, which allows you to meet those milestones in a more real way. Maybe less measurable, but more meaningful. And so she really handed us the responsibility. You know, she really gave us the space to figure out how we wanted to do something. And that just means based in a big picture, she didn't micromanage us, you know, and in other ways, she looked at us and she really saw us and she brought us ideas and mirrored back to us what she saw we were doing. So she would say, oh, I see that you're interested in this. Have you thought about this other thing? Or she would say, oh, Sarah, I see that like this is really important to you, just so that I could feel like, oh, I can actually bring my whole self to this job. You know, it's not a problem that I really like messy, open-ended forest activities. Like, that's a good thing, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So she would support you in the same way that you were supporting the children to grow into who they were.
Yeah. And she would sort of jokingly say, like, don't make me have to do that work for you, you know, which is like the best challenge, you know, because it is our work to do, you know.
And then when it comes to relating with parents in the daycare, I know that Over the Rainbow, you said, is welcoming of all families and, you know, all families have all different kinds of approaches. So what's that like having kids from so many different kinds of families, having parents with so many different kinds of approaches and, you know, sort of digesting all of that as the childcare provider who's interacting with those parents and the kids of those parents?
I would say one of the challenges was that I am not a parent myself. Mm-hmm. So while I even if I was a parent and I was also an educator, those roles would be different. But not being a parent myself meant that at certain times I knew that I didn't quite understand what it meant to be a parent. So that's just a reflection. But we just stay in dialogue, you know, and I would see how much communication different parents wanted. And then every Friday I wrote a roundup, which was a summary of the work we were doing together as a group of children and me, so that the parents could sort of see what I was observing and I could share the work we were doing together and the themes that were coming up. And maybe there was some more interpersonal conflict that week, or maybe there was some interest in a particular idea that the parents might be surprised or interested to hear about at home. So I wanted to do that in order to sort of keep an open dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And it was the same roundup for all the parents?
For my group.
For the 8 kids in your group.
Yeah. And then I had some parents who were really wanting more contact and more discussion. And sometimes that meant phone calls and sometimes that meant in-person discussion. And, you know, some parents really didn't want that kind of communication. So just sort of seeing where people are at, you know, the you know, it's the main thing. There's another sort of like balance, which is like, you want open communication, but you also want like respect between, like, I want to respect that home life is different than daycare. It just is. Like, daycare is not home. And so, like, I never wanted parents to feel responsible for anything that took place at the daycare. That was my responsibility, you know? So, for example, if a child like was really, I can't think of, like, disagreeable or just didn't want to do anything, I never tattletold on the kid to the parents, because that's not, it's not their responsibility to deal with that behavior once they get home.
Yeah, you're taking full responsibility for the child while they're with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So since the pandemic, I'm curious, where has your heart been when it comes to childcare? And I mean, like, both in terms of, you know, the kids that you've been seeing every day over the rainbow, but also just on a larger scale. Like, there's been a massive interruption to the status quo, and have you been thinking about what that means for kids?
Yeah, I love that question. I really love that question. Well, the day, so I haven't returned to daycare since the pandemic. So since March 13th, I haven't. So I initially was asked by a daycare parent, like, the that day, because all of a sudden, you know, immediately parents said, what am I going to do with my kid, you know? So I got a request from a parent that day or the day after, could you be my kid's art teacher while we are all on lockdown? And I was like, you know what, I'm not sure I'm up to do, like, Zoom. I don't even think I knew what Zoom was at that time, but, like, online art instruction. But I will just start sending out art prompts for kids. And so I just started doing that. And I've been doing that ever since. So today was day 105. And
oh, wow.
I'm no longer sending out art prompts just for kids, but for people of all ages. And they're open-ended. And so kids and adults and everybody's been, they email me their work every day, and then I email it out the next day so people can see what they're doing. So that's one place my heart has been. The other thing is just, I mean, on the one hand, I feel like, wow, what an interesting transformative moment if parents are able to be home with their kids, for parents and kids to get to know each other in new ways. Not just the in-between transitional moments, but, like, the whole day. And I think that's really exciting. One thing also I think, though, is that, like, wow, what a catastrophic situation we're in, and what kind of world do we have here for our kids, and how do we protect them, and how do we make sure the world is increasingly better so by the time they're adults, things are not just harder and harder and harder for them.
Yeah. This could be a whole interview up into itself, but just, like, in terms of the answers to that question, any, like, what are the key areas? What are the key areas that we're going to need for that?
Well, one thing that this pandemic has done, which is, you know, profound, is it's sort of like there's the straightforwardness of cause and effect is laid bare, you know? Like, if certain measures are taken by government, certain peoples are protected and certain people aren't protected. And even if the government says they are protected, but they're not, we see the truth, you know? And children are uncomfortable with jokes sometimes because they don't understand the confusion of truth, you know? Like, children, most children until they're around 9 don't understand sarcasm or irony. It's not pleasant for them, because when you're saying one thing but you mean the opposite, children don't, like, they don't respond well to it because it doesn't make any sense in their minds. And so,
and it can be destabilizing, right?
Like, 100%. Like, 100% destabilizing. So it's like all those jokes that are like, haha, like, I cut your ear off, or, you know, my whatever, where's my thumb? Like, for children, those are not good jokes. And that's the thing that's interesting and that I love working with kids, is that they actually just want to hear straightforward the truth, you know, like, just really direct. all the time. And for adults, actually, that can be quite challenging because in an adult world, we're not used to just being really direct, you know? I will miss you when I don't see you, but I will hold you in my heart and I will think of you often. You know, that's a thing a child in your care wants to hear kind of frequently, but it's not a way we talk as adults. So all this to say, like, I think we have to be honest as adults about the world we are a part of and not lie to ourselves and others and pretend it's something else. You know, if we don't make sure the world is a healthy place by the time our kids are adults, then it won't be. You know, so maybe just the massive work of actually, like, trying to build a world that is true to the values we say we hold, which is, I don't know how we do that, but, like, you know, that's, I've been thinking about, like, all the parents who are talking to their children about racism, you know, in a maybe more in-depth way now than they have, and how painful that's going to be for children, but also parents, because children are going to really take that into their heart, you know, the cruelty that people do to each other. And maybe there's something there we can learn from them if we can go back to our child place. And maybe that will help. I don't know. This is a rambling answer to your question.
I like it. I like where you're headed, though.
Yeah.
And I really like what you said about honesty. And it's a very simple way of looking at like broader social change or justice.
Yeah.
Like, how can we be more honest as adults in the way that our kids are?
Exactly. Yeah.
You posted something really kind on Facebook about Over the Rainbow and the different educators there. And I'm wondering, can you expand a little bit on what it means to bring spirituality to your childcare work? Because you sort of suggested that's what they do.
Yeah. So part of it, I think, is just about allowing intuition. So I worked at Over the Rainbow in two chunks of time. And the first chunk of time was around 2005 to 2008 or 9. And I worked with some educators at that time who were really good at holding stillness in particular. I think they both, at a certain point, trained to be yoga teachers. Mm-hmm. And one of them was definitely a meditator. And they just could sit and hold the space of quiet with the children they were in. And
does that mean the kids were quiet as well, or just the educator?
Sometimes both, mm-hmm. and sometimes just the educator. But just, like, it takes a lot of confidence as an educator to have strong enough relationships with the kids to just sit and not do anything. Mm. So the children feel safe and they feel they can go do their thing. They can play, as we used to call it at Over the Rainbow, is do your work. You know, they can do the things they're motivated to do. And you can sit and watch them and they know you are there. Mm-hmm. So when we have new educators come in to train with us, we have interns from Vanier and Concordia. Often they would be moving at a higher, they'd be like sort of vibrating at a higher frequency. They'd be like moving around a lot. Because it's, you want to make sure people see that you are working and that you are contributing. And I was always just like, could you stop moving? But you can't really, because you're nervous and you don't want to be seen as lazy, you know? But the thing is that, like, if you hold the space and you sit down, it does feel spiritual in a certain way, because it's like a deep trust of yourself and in the relationship with others. And you're just sort of, well, I don't know, maybe sort of like in an active meditation where you are just there and you are just in the moment with the children and nothing needs to happen. You know, it's just the moment as it is. Mm. And that, in combination with an active intuition where you let yourself come up with experiences for the children that just come to you through that kind of process of sort of receiving what is there. To me, that's the spiritual practice of early childhood education.
And those students that you mentioned who were with Over the Rainbow, I guess it would have been for varying degrees of time, but no matter how long they were there, did you find that they started to sort of notice the slower vibrations of the educators who had been there a long time? And did they start to pick up on that, or did it just
depend on as it? Long as their fear wasn't like really in the forefront of their mind. You know, as long as they felt secure. Like some people, it's a very confusing field. Like, it's a very confusing métier because it's not product oriented. It's not, you're not trying to, with the children, produce anything beautiful or anything at all. You're trying to help the children feel safe and secure and powerful in themselves to be happy most of the time, or a significant portion of the time, to grow, to continue to grow and learn and relate, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think the lack of deliverable can be really disorienting for a new teacher, because what do they have to show for their work? Is their work good enough? You know, and there was like, there's just fear, like, do the parents like me? Do the kids like me? Am I doing a good enough job? You know, what is my supervising teacher saying? Like, the teachers from Vanier and Concordia, sometimes they would ask open-ended questions and the student teacher would be like, I got this criticism, you know? And I was like, I think they just want to hear what you have to say, you know? I think they just want to know what you think about this, you know? So just, I think it is really confusing.
I just want to pick up on something that you said earlier, combined with what you just said about deliverables. I noticed a drastic change having moved from Quebec to Ontario. And that one of the things that you mentioned earlier about all the different categories you're supposed to, you know, cognitive, emotional, fine motor, gross motor. And there's like all those categories are broken into subcategories. And so did you get 3A today? Did you get 3B? Did you get 3? Yes. Well, if you didn't get 3D today, you better make sure you get it tomorrow. And then you've got to track it. And like, how much of an educator's time is spent, you know, quantifying each little, like each activity. Yeah. And how ridiculous is it to take one activity, like say dress up, and say that, well, that satisfied, I guess, dramatic or but like, you know, I can't remember what the category fits in.
Yeah.
But like, it actually satisfies a holistic range of childhood needs.
Yes.
You know, depending on how you look at it. So
yes, and then, absolutely.
And then with what you said about deliverables, especially when childcare is thought of in a quantifiable way, or like if people are paying out of pocket for it, they want to know, well, what did I get for my money? And that's something that I see a lot in Ontario, that it's sort of like pits childcare centers against one another as they compete for kids, and they want to make themselves look attractive. So there's this idea that we prepare them for kindergarten. So like, your child will be learning their ABCs, you know, when they're like three or four. It's, gosh, now that I've said all that, I don't know if I have a question about it.
Well, I can respond.
Yeah, like, please.
Because I totally agree. And So there's a few things I want to say. One of them is, so alongside my work as an early childhood educator, I've been doing an undergraduate degree in psychology. Mm-hmm. And I've always wondered where the heck do these developmental milestones come from? What is going on? Because some of them don't make any sense. Like, and why are they valuable, you know? So in my history of psychology course, I found out. And they come from behavioral psychologists in development of normative white children in a sort of eugenic project of the 20s to 40s in America. They were constructed to show how white people are superior to others, based on these milestones they came up with. And we still use very similar milestones today.
Can you give an example?
So, yes, I can give you two examples. This one psychologist, Wundt, who's actually German, he developed this toy. Like, it wasn't a toy, but it's a toy now. It's that thing where a child can only fit one shape they have into the same shaped hole. So you know that toy where you put the blocks in, that was a thing to check a certain kind of intelligence of a child. And the other one that always infuriates me is that by age two, a child should be able to identify anybody's gender. Mm. And I've never met a two-year-old who can identify anybody's gender. I've met children who know what their gender expression is, but it's not something that, you know, a two-year-old is that concerned with more than someone identifying, for example, as a dog or Dora the Explorer.
Can you explain a little bit why the shape toy is particularly normative? And
I don't honestly know why identifying certain shapes and being able to put them in a hole is considered normative. And I don't know that it ever has been explained beyond that time. Yeah, I can't explain it because I don't know. I just learned about a few of these things where I was like, this bell went off in my head where I was like, oh my God, we're still using that. But it also prepares you to be a good soldier, right? If you can figure out what buttons to push and you can represent them in another way. Because that's the other thing that these psychology tests were doing, was getting people ready to go to war. So I don't know. Okay, so that's one tangent. Another, so the milestones we're using are archaic. Another thing is, when I worked in the Ontario system, we were given these huge charts, and every day we had to fill them in, and we had to meet all these different milestones. Mm-hmm. And you cannot meet all the milestones they create in a day, so you have to lie. And then you have to lie, like, every day. And that is supposed to be on display for parents to see, and it makes no sense. It's a very confusing grid, and it's a lie. And it just feels terrible, because it's like, I actually want to show what I'm doing. I want to show the work we're doing. It's awesome. But instead, I have this crappy grid, this tiny grid on the wall, you know?
Yeah.
And it also speaks to a distrust of early childhood educators, a sort of like over the sort of suspicion always that we're not doing enough and we need to be over observed, which happens where like every so often the rules change for what's expected, you know, of us. And, you know, instead of saying we trust these educators and we want to pay them well and we want them to feel secure and we want them to stick around, they say, here's some more regulations, or we're going to come in another time to inspect you. You know, it's like the reverse of trusting the value of the workers.
Yeah. And actually that sort of leads me to a question, again, going back to the pandemic, and as you know, different regions go back into childcare situations, whether it's like a large center or just like a home daycare or other small sort of settings, they're being regulated in different ways. Have you had any, you know, particular thoughts around some of these regulations, particularly in terms of expecting kids to social distance or not share their germs?
Well, I'm not up to date on what's happening in Ontario, but in Quebec, there at no point were anybody from like the Association of Early Childhood Educators or like home daycare owners, were they consulted? Mm. Nobody was consulted. And I know that from the public school level, also no one was consulted. So that's dangerous. Like, you have to ask the people who are doing the work what is possible. You just do. And one thing I am concerned about is that I know that the centers are going to do the very best they can. They're going to work their butts off. But just developmentally, like, we learn through touch and we learn through relationship at that age. Mm-hmm. We learn through sharing and we learn through collaboration, and that's what we teach. So I'm concerned just on the level of child development of like rushing kids to be back in daycare centers, but demanding that they not do anything they naturally feel called to do. Are we going to see some negative impacts in the future of that, you know? Or is it possible to pull off what they're being asked of, you know? Like, Is this a doable thing? You know, like, the other thing is just babies. You know, we already know this. Like, there's been studies where babies were horribly mistreated and not touched, and like all the negative outcomes for the rest of their life. Like encouraging people to not touch each other for the whole day. Like it's not sounding good.
Right.
So I don't think I had this other idea in my mind. I had this sort of utopic idea where parents could apply for money to either pay one of themselves to be the stay-at-home parent, or they could hire somebody to be the, you know, the live-in, not live-in, but like regular educator or caregiver, so that the bubble could be really small.
Sure.
Instead of putting kids all in one spot. Right. And saying they will stay 1 meter apart, because it's just a lie. They can't.
Right.
Yeah. They won't. They can't.
Yeah. It was similar in Ontario, actually, with the lack of consultation, and the response from various kinds of childcare providers was that these regulations, first of all, are going to be really difficult to implement. Please don't ask us in a short time frame without, without additional funding to have one childcare provider for far fewer children, not allowed to increase our fees. I mean, certainly my response to some of the regulations were, I'm going to practice civil disobedience. I run a small home daycare, and the regulations apply to home daycares as well, according to the government. And they were saying things like, hold toddlers with a cloth. Each toddler gets their own cloth. And when you're applying sunscreen, wash your hands in between each sunscreen application. And avoid water play and sand play. But if you do play with water and sand, try to have individualized containers of water and sand. And the list goes on. And it was just like,
it's absurd. Yeah.
It was almost antithetical to what childcare is. It's, how can you have a childcare setting where there isn't sharing and the touching of the same things, or touching of one another and hugs?
You're listening to an interview with educator and artist Sarah Mangle. She's talking to journalist and home daycare provider Joanne Panhale. This is CKUT 90.3 FM. Thanks for listening.
I really wanted Legault to just, I was like, has he met a kid? It felt like they were a bunch of, our government was like, they were just smoking cigars in a hot tub, and they were like, I know what we'll do. We'll make one towel per baby. It's just like, what? It felt like they're a frat house of overgrown, not overgrown, but aged out frat boys, just coming up with random ideas. And it's really insulting to the work, and they could have just asked you,
Right.
They could have just said, okay, we'd like to do this. What do you need in order to do this? Do you think it's possible? What would be the baseline requirements to pull this off? Is it doable? Also, how much time would you need to prepare? What do you think you can provide safely?
Yeah. And while we're sort of in this sort of talking about larger social questions around childcare, can you talk a little bit about the economics of childcare? You have already talked a little bit about wages. And I'm just wondering in terms of there's larger social discussions going on right now about defunding the police, for example.
Yeah.
And putting that money back into the services for the public that matter, that help create healthy societies. Can you talk a little bit about that as it relates to childcare?
Well, there's been calls for universal free childcare in Canada since the 60s. And it's just so tiring because it's whenever there's a new election, it's sort of dangled, and then it just never happens. And that's really disappointing. And, Quebec has had the best situation in Canada in terms of paying educators well and being between $5 and $8 a day for parents. So that's, that is, I think, the best in Canada. Educators are still not considered teachers. And so the skills you get as being an educator are not necessarily as transferable as having experience being a public teacher, because it's a CEGEP degree or a college degree. So when you finish being a daycare educator, like, you can't necessarily take all that knowledge you have and apply it in a new career as easy as you could if you were a public school teacher. So that's a little bit frustrating. And also, it seems like the idea of the job is still that we're all wives of rich men, and so our salary doesn't really need to pay us or something. Mm. Like, because of the gender story of the work, we're not all women, but we're sort of perceived to be. In fact, I've heard that the home daycare packages that home daycares get call all educators women. Mm. They just refer to us as women. So I feel like if there were more men in our field, our pay rate would reflect that. And I feel like educators themselves know how hard the work is and really value the work. And parents, when their children are in care, when they really are able to see what the work is, they can really value it. But I feel like in a big picture way, it's not valued. It's not understood, and it's not perceived as skilled or challenging. And that's reflected in how well we're paid or perceived. But the situation where parents have to pay so much money out of pocket for childcare is also impossible. And I think also speaks to gender dynamics, because I think when the Harper government came in, we really saw this. Like, the Harper government said, you know, we think moms should stay at home. So I think there still is this idea that it's more preferable if moms stay home with the kids and not work.
Do you mean that was in terms of policy?
Yeah, like that's why they were like, we don't want affordable childcare, because really the mom should be at home with her kids, you know? So yeah. It seems like in the ether, there's still a discomfort with early childhood education.
I got a question for you about fatigue with taking care of kids. I find that one of the most tiring things is the constant openness that, I mean, it helps when you're with kids to be attentive and open to their like broad range of emotions that change on a dime sometimes, and to have that kind of constant empathy with them can be really tiring. Can you discuss some of the ways that you have dealt with, if that has been an experience for you, first of all, and then if so, how have you dealt with it?
Yeah, it is tiring. That's just real. that's real. And the way that it's sort of discussed in the field is that you have to really love it for it to be sustaining for you. Because if you don't have the love there for the work, it's just going to be tiring. And I think one thing is that it's really meaningful. It really is meaningful. And the heart work of it is generative. Like, if you are able to get enough sleep and show up to the work and eat enough good food and are able to be present for it, it gives back. Mm. But if you're tired and if you're stressed and if you're not able to receive that goodness, the love part of the job, then you're tired. You know, it's tiring. So, and if you work in a place like Over the Rainbow where you are valued as yourself, it's more generative than if you work at a place where when you want to do anything that's outside of the norm, it's criticized. So when my ideas are like, people are like, yes, let's do it, then it's easier to have energy to show up to do the work. But yeah, that's why my schedule, why I work 9 to 2, because I was like, I can sustainably do this for 25 hours a week. I can really be there and I can really do it for that time. But if I try to do it full time, I don't think it's sustainable, because it does take so much. And just, you can't pee when you need to pee. You know, mm-hmm. This, yeah. You know, sometimes you're hungry and you have to really wait till you can eat, because you're responsible for this group of kids and you have to keep them safe. So the sustaining, this like pushing aside of your own needs in order to be there for the group is a real balance, and you have to sort of sort it out for yourself. But
go ahead and then I'll ask my question.
I found that studying psychology really helped. Like I found that like feeding my own brain while doing the work was really helpful. I also started researching attachment theory. Mm-hmm. Like if I could keep learning new things while doing the job and apply those new things and mm-hmm. be like, oh, I wonder this, then I had more energy for it. So it's like, if I can feed myself while I am feeding the kids, then things are in a great balance, you know? Mm-hmm.
How would you set your own boundaries with the kids in terms of like, you know, your own self-care too? Like if you happen to be just exhausted or you were grumpy or you just really didn't feel like doing that one, you know, thing the kid wanted you to do or playing that one fantasy that the kid was really into, how do you set that boundary? And, you know, is there gray area for you when you set a boundary?
I love that question. I really learned that early on from the educators I worked with, about, you know, 15 years ago. Like they really showed through their actions like how they wanted to be treated. So they would say like, you are yelling at me and that's not okay, and I'm walking away now. So like through they were sort of trying to model self-respect by respecting themselves. Mm. So I find like it's really a practice. It's like really a practice. So like the more I did it, the more patience I had, and the more I didn't take things personally, and the more humor I could find in things, and the more openness I could have. So like I like to try to say no with kindness and with love, you know, no, I'm not going to do that. No, thanks. You know, I don't want to play that right now, you know, thank you, you know, and really feel that, you know, just be like, okay, no thanks, you know. So, and then sometimes being stressed or being over caffeinated or being sad or tired, you know, the best practice I could do is just tell them, you know, like, I'm grumpy today. Like, or when the kids say, I wish I was at home, you know, I don't want to be here. It's be like, you know what? Me too. You know? That's normal. It's normal to miss your parents and it's normal to not be here, you know? And I guess it's all a big practice of not taking things personally and just remembering like, none of this is about me. It's really not about me. They're at an egocentric time of development. It's all about them, you know? And so nothing they do is to disrespect me. Ever. Yeah. It's even if they would say I hate you, it was like, oh, you're telling me you're mad. Like, you're really angry, you know.
Yeah.
And I can understand that you're really angry, you know. So it's a practice of, and then the gray area, like, it's kids, gray areas are hard for kids, but like I could say, oh, today I totally do feel like playing with you, you know, and today, and maybe tomorrow I won't, you know, maybe tomorrow I'm going to want to just like sit and watch everybody. So that kind of thing.
One of the sort of pressing questions I have for you is, as a care provider, how do you negotiate, fantasy versus reality? Like you're the kid's rock. You're their anchor.
Yeah.
You need to let them know like what's real, what's going on, what's going to happen next. But at the same time, they might want you to like be a pony, or whatever they want you, you know, like, and how do you make sure that you're not confusing the kids if you get into that fantasy play with them?
I love that question. One thing I always used to do is I put up signs so the children could expect what was going to happen tomorrow. And children had particular jobs that they were doing because they really like to feel a purpose. So every day one kid would have quiet time, which is 20 minutes in the whole daycare, and they could play whatever they wanted and no one would interrupt them. They would, their space would be respected. And that was because they're in a group all the time, and when it's free play, they have to negotiate like their own space kind of constantly. So I wanted them to feel like the space was just theirs and they could just breathe. Mm-hmm. And so every day there was a sign up that had a picture of which kid was going to have quiet time. And then the other one was which kid was going to be the teacher, and their job was to wash the table after snack and to pick the yoga pretzel cards, which were, are these fantastic cards with different yoga poses. And they would pick 10 cards and that would be our yoga routine for the day. So that those were their jobs. And then also like the central thing we were going to do that day, there was a photo. And one thing was, one photo I had was a question mark against a space backdrop. And that meant I don't have a photo for this. It's a surprise to you because I don't have a photo representation. So you're just going to have to wait to see tomorrow. But they, two kids got it in their head when they came in that day that we were going to space, that we were literally going to space, that we were going to build a rocket and we were going to go to space. And so I showed up and two kids ran at me and they said, "We're going to space. We're going to space. I can't believe it. I'm so excited." You know? And I was like, "Oh no." I was like, this is not good, you know, because I can't tell that lie with them, because by the end of the day, we will not be in space, you know, like there is no way. So I was like, "I'm just going to have to be real with you. We are not going to space. We do not have a rocket. We cannot get in it. And we will not, if we want to go to space, we would have to train and go to NASA and, you know," so just to be really straightforward, because they think it's possible. It's possible we could take an airplane today. It's possible we could go to another country, you know?
Yeah.
We just have to tell you the truth, you know?
Yeah.
Because they thought it was real. Yeah.
Preventing their disappointment, right?
Yeah. And then my student teacher at the time, who was fabulous, she was like, "But we can play going to space." And I was like, "Yes, absolutely. We can definitely play going to space, but we will not be going. Like, it will be pretend," because I just couldn't deal with the heartbreak later. So yeah, it's like sort of the overstating to be like, this is a game and it's like a fantastic game and it's going to feel great, but we will not actually be doing the thing. Yeah. Well, 'cause they don't know the difference at that time. Like sometimes kids think that if they open the door to the front of the daycare, then their parent will arrive. That it is by them standing there that their parent shows up. It's like their sense of logic is so different from adult logic. We sometimes forget.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many things that it would be fun to talk to you about. But one last sort of big question I have for you is about encouraging kids to play together. Say they would all rather be talking with you and maybe talking over each other to talk to you. How do you get that, their sort of social focus onto each other more? How do you weave that?
I try to just safely get myself out of the room.
Yeah.
So I sit in the doorway and I become very boring. So I'm like, I just don't say anything. You know what? Then if they're like, "What are you doing?" You know, I'm like, "I'm sitting watching you." You know, like, I try just not to be interesting. If I see a child that's like struggling to interact with other kids, another thing I did sometimes is I give quiet time to two kids. So there'd be two kids in the daycare by themselves and they could play on their own or they could play together. And just having a little bit less chaos and quiet and the possibility that they might interact, I saw some really interesting things. Like I might slowly see one child give another child a gift or a toy and then move away. I saw often two kids playing together just side by side, what we call parallel play, you know, and not talking and then slowly interacting. So I think it's just like giving space and time for it to eventually unfold. But yeah, it's sort of like be boring and refuse to play, which is not advice I think people get in educator school, but it will help them play with each other.
Cool. I know that you mentioned the art prompts that you've been doing every day. I also know that you have a coloring book of worries and assurances, because I have that book. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And by the way, side note, my daughter has a quick question. Mavis, she's 7 now. She, you might remember her. She was there.
I do.
The same time as you. She wants to know what you made that coloring book with. Like, was it a pen or was it pencil crayons?
Pencil. Just a pencil.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. She still loves the book that we have. So if anybody is interested in your prompts, are they available to other people who might be listening?
Yeah, or anybody can participate and they can just email me and I'll put them on the list. And my email is Sarah, S-A-R-A-H dot Mangle, M-A-N-G-L-E at gmail.com. And they're free.
Cool. I saw you talking with someone named Gayla on Facebook about, you know, moving forward in the pandemic area with childcare. And she was musing about homeschooling, but in a group, a small group sort of way, like supporting one another in their homeschooling endeavors. Or, I mean, I've been wondering if school boards can help support people who do decide to.
I hope so.
Home too. Yeah. Anyway, it'd be interesting to continue the conversation. So,
yeah, totally. Yeah. So Gala is, I want to shout out to Gala. Gala Wilkie was one of the educators that was at Over the Rainbow when I started, and she was a real big mentor. And yeah, I think we're going to see a shift towards homeschooling in a massive way. And I'm really excited about that. I think parents are going to find that they have a lot of knowledge to share. And I'm really excited to see where that goes.
Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you.
That was an interview by Joanne Penhell with Montreal-based artist and educator Sarah Mangle, talking about her child-centered holistic approach to early childhood education, as well as some of the daily art prompts that she's been sending out, and as well as some conversation about how childcare workers and educators have been handling major shifts during the COVID-19 pandemic. Thanks for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. You can find Sarah and see some of her art as well as coloring books that she's done at sarahmangle.ca, SarahMangle.ca. You can find her on Facebook as well and on Instagram. And you can sign up for her daily art prompts, her daily art ideas at sarahmangle@gmail.com. Thanks again to Sarah and to journalist and daycare provider Johan Penhale for sharing their conversation with us here on In the Motherhood on CKUT. And thanks for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. In the Motherhood will be back next month. Thanks for listening. You can follow us on Facebook at CKUT-InTheMotherhood, and you can email us at InTheMotherhood@CKUT.ca with any questions or show ideas or anything at all. Thanks again, and see you next month. Still going.
slow the spread of the virus, we need to press pause again. That's why once more, we need to stay home and avoid all non-essential travel. Gatherings are prohibited in red zones and are to be avoided in orange zones. And it's important to keep following the everyday health measures. Let's press pause again to curb the spread. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves properly. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Bunga 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 bun